You're listening to Catalyst Talks, conversations with change agents, outliers, superheroes, and truly conscious leaders modeling what it is to be an unstoppable force for good and truth in this world. What lit these catalysts on fire to do their work, and what nuggets of wisdom can they share with a world literally on fire? I'm your host, Stephanie Traeger. I'm a transformational catalyst and life coach to maverick change agents in business, leadership, and life. On this podcast, I wear an eclectic mix of hats, including earthkeeper, wayfinder, truth teller, coach, lawyer, business, and impact strategist. My intention is holding space for higher purpose, peak wellness, soul mastery, and deeper impact so we can live in harmony with ourselves, each other, and nature. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. If you love it, please share and spread the word. We're on YouTube and all the podcast platforms. See the show notes on catalysttalks.com for links and enjoy this episode. Welcome back to Catalyst Talks. We're talking to John Perlin today, author of A Forest Journey, The Role of Trees in the Fate of Civilization, and Let It Shine, The 6,000-Year Story of Solar Energy, among other works. He's an early scholar, author, and voice for solar power with a knack for science and historical journalism on what matters, forests and power. Welcome, John. Your life's work has been to discover and document the history of forests from the distant past to our current environmental mess, threading the story with the role wood products served in developing civilizations. We share our love of trees, and you tell a remarkable story in this book, Forest Journey. And it's not a new book, though it has a new beginning, and it's told through the lens of wood, which is something I'm a forest keeper, a lover of trees and ancient trees in particular. And I really have never seen a book or a story told that really could take us through this journey of human civilization through the lens of wood. In your book, you share tales of devastation, but it's also like this beautiful journalistic style. So there's a light and there's hope and there's information. And what I really love and that I'm hoping to glean from you today, because I have this pocket and curiosity, I'm sure that other listeners do too, it's that idea of cycles and patterns, right? The cycles and patterns of civilizations, and you write the journey of them. So I'm looking forward to diving into this. And I'll start us off with a quote from the book that I chose because it's one that it speaks to the research and exploration I'm doing now for the book that I'm writing. So this quote, "Sadly, the present assault on our forests is part of the same cycle begun thousands of years ago. Every old world starts out as virgin land attractive to human settlement. Subsequent exploitation by humans wears out the land, forcing them to move on to their next new world. This quest for new frontiers, which many have thought peculiar in the American experience, is repeated again and again." This plays out so much in not only trees and forests, but just about everything that we take, use, and repeat. So, John, thanks for being here. Can you take me on a forest walk of a few million years?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to emphasize that the book is, there's like 150 new pages in this edition. And the first edition went back 5,600 years. This book goes back 380 million years ago when the first true tree, and what we mean by true tree is a plant that has deep roots, a trunk, has a bark, which we call lignin, and has branches and has leaves and reached a height of 150 feet. And the first true tree was Archaeopteris. And if you'd like, I can take out from my fossil collection some examples of that tree, or I can send you them, whichever you would like. Because I spent 2 weeks in western Pennsylvania digging for this true tree. And the site, which is about 45 minutes from State College, Pennsylvania, is one of the best sites in the world for Archaeopteris, the first true tree. And the first true tree set a precedent and a continued cycle, which to this day remains. That is the takedown of carbon dioxide and the increase of oxygen, the change of the waterways from just torrents into regulated streams, to a check on erosion from the sun, wind, and rain, and also creating an entire environment that welcomed large-sized animals to the terrestrial Earth.
So you're saying this first true tree was 380 million years old?
Yeah, Archaeopteryx. We call it geoengineering as a new idea of what a tree does. What a tree does is it geoengineers by changing the atmosphere, by changing the entire landscape into a favorable environment for life.
Okay, my brain doesn't really wrap around 380 million years. So how old is the oldest tree that you've ever seen?
I think, let me think, probably, I don't know, about 300 or 400 years old.
You haven't seen the redwoods, the 1,000-year-old trees in the redwoods?
I have passed them by, and we talked about this before, and both intact and on logging trucks. But what's interesting about, and this might help you wrap your brain around the first true tree, is I have fossils of the bark, the limbs, the leaves, and actually the charcoal, because the trees created sufficient oxygen never before seen on Earth that facilitated forest fires. So you can see the leaves, and they're in rock, so that gives you an idea of the antiquity. And what's really interesting about the charcoal that I have in my Archaeopteryx, which is the name of the first true tree, it's the charcoal that was created by the oxygenated air that allowed for forest fires. And actually, in the little museum in this very small town of Renovo, Pennsylvania, which is way up far away from the madding crowd, they have the first four-legged creatures that entered the earth from the ocean to become our ancestors.
Wow. So, John, I'm here as you're speaking, I'm hearing all of and I've been thinking about as I'm reviewing and reading your book, there's so much in there and it's really beautiful. And I'm thinking about and hearing you speak to all the benefits, so the benefits of the first true tree are similar, if not the same, as the benefits of trees today.
Right. Well, trees are really actually doing this edition really impressed to me how brilliant yet fragile the whole natural system is for life, in that it's fragile because it's easily destroyed. As we saw in an event called the end-Permian extinction, where deforestation and increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere resulted in almost losing the entire life cycle on the planet.
So wait, what year was that?
That was 252 million years ago.
Okay, so what then would you say to someone who says that climate change right now, and I'm just asking this question completely detached, is that it's way more than just what humans are doing, even though it's very much, we're affected by our own behavior, yet the change of the climate on the earth and what is unfolding, is it only us?
Well, today it is. I mean, the end permanent extinction actually shows what we're doing. You've heard of the tar sands?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it was actually a similar physical happening of what we're doing with the tar sands, for example, where it wasn't the explosions of the volcanoes. It was the lava that was flowing on petroleum-rich rocks that created the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And also what's very interesting is leaves of trees stop absorbing the carbon dioxide when you get temperatures above 104 degrees Fahrenheit. See, the top of a leaf releases oxygen, and the bottom of the leaf have these little microholes called stomata. And the stomata is what acts to absorb the carbon dioxide for the physical or chemical process we call photosynthesis. And so when it gets too hot, those receptacles close and no longer can do photosynthesis. So the trees died. Once the trees died, the herbivores died. And once the herbivores died, the carnivores didn't have any food, right?
Mm.
The whole life cycle on Earth was teetering almost to a non-living planet. where we lost about, I think it's about 80-90% of the land animals and about 75% of the sea animals. Because what happened was, once the trees died, the soil was vulnerable to all the forces of erosion. And so what it did is it poured into the ocean and created a living hell for the sea animals, like the fish, the shellfish, etc. And so we see in these two cycles, Archaeopteris and the end permanent extinction, what can happen to us today, because we're accelerating the end permanent extinction right now in our like total stupidity.
Yes. And, you know, when we first were talking, I found it really interesting how in your book, and then when we spoke about this, around forests are like, we see them through this anthropomorphic lens, right? And how they serve us and wood and how our use as a forest even to regulate climate and soil. So let me ask you this. What is the purpose of trees if not for human beings?
Well, first of all, there is no purpose of trees because trees... For the trees themselves, I mean, the trees just grow. The trees don't have minds. They don't have...
Oh, I would disagree.
Well...
They have psyche. They have souls.
I think trees are far too valuable to have to anthropomorphize them. Trees, whatever, you know, we don't know trees unless we're a tree, right? I mean, I can tell you that I feel when I go up in the forest every day, I feel much better. I'll tell you that I love to be in forests. I have since I've been very young. Mm-hmm. I'm not putting down the amazing psychological effects they have for humanity. All I'm saying is because we really, I don't think it's wise to anthropomorphize trees. One of the reasons is because by anthropomorphizing trees, we came to a very stupid conclusion, which was that old growth was decadent. Old growth, you know, was weak. It's sort of like, you know, having to have a walker or something. When in fact, we're discovering through science that old growth actually speeds up the carbon dioxide absorption and also acts as a carbon bank. And the new growth, actually, if we don't allow it to grow into old growth, we actually produce more carbon dioxide than the younger trees absorb. So what I'm trying to say is we can't allow our human thoughts to say this is how a tree acts, but we can worship trees for the way they act to save both humanity and all living things.
Yeah, I mean, I have a belief that and an experience that there is sentience in ancient trees, and it's not through it's not humanizing it. It's really like just an experience of being in the presence and the wisdom and the cosmic intelligence to me. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. There's this any being with life force on this planet that has been here for thousands of years.
Millions of years.
But trees that are alive today, there are trees alive today that have been here for thousands of years alive, receiving information, holding and storing information, sending information.
Well, of course, they have a genetic information. There's no proof that they're communicating with each other. That's not acceptable scientifically. As I say, trees provide so much life. We don't have to go there. We can just look at what a tree does. What a tree does is it creates a living earth. And we see that in hundreds of millions of years ago. What happened was debris from trees started to deoxygenate the shallow seas. And there were certain animals that had lungs, like we call lungfish, and they could lift their heads out of the water and survive holding on to that debris. And so they made their way to Earth, which lungfish do today. And actually, we're coming to the conclusion that lungfish are the closest relative to everything terrestrially. And so the trees were both a life giver on the land, but also a life taker in the oceans, creating this deoxygenated seas where the, you know, fish, lots of fish died. these lungfish type of animals were able to survive. And also because the fish in the Devonian times, which was the times where the first true tree was growing, were huge carnivores. And so these little guys who had lungs could get out of the sea from, you know, escape these giant carnivores and make it on land, where on land, the trees had created a, I would say, a paradise, and they could metabolize because the trees provided all this oxygen, and they could also metabolize because the takedown of carbon dioxide by these trees allowed for a much cooler earth. So it's an amazing, I mean, it's almost mythical what happened. I see it as this big cosmic event, and I don't have to place intelligence or whatever. I just say this happened. Actually, and the opposite happened with the end-permanent extinction, but and we can see from the end-permanent extinction what we're creating today. In fact, I don't know what the weather is like where you are, but in most of the world, it's becoming like life-killing. So let me conclude. It doesn't take any brilliance to say that, you know, when you get over 104 degrees Fahrenheit day after day, it's not life-giving. Also, I'd like to add that the trees not only provided a greatly oxygenated earth, but also created water by trans-evaporation. And so it allowed for a much more wetter earth where other plants could survive too.
So we got carbon sinks, precipitation, fire, wooden building, medicines, food, habitat, climate, mycelium networks, feeding the networks. There is communication and beauty, right? And so I would actually say I do come to trees with a bit of a spiritual approach as well. And
as do I.
And I, so I go back to days when I was young and like 30 years ago, and I had certain knowing just because I knew, right? I knew and had no way to know in 1995 that trees sequestered carbon. I had no way to know that. I knew that trees were good for the soil just because I was living there, and you can see when they're cut what happens. The soil
and forest soil is so rich.
And when you clear cut, what happens? You watch mudslides and you watch mountains slide. And right. So I feel that we are in a world that is waiting for science and facts that are corroborated through science to prove everything before we take action to like follow our common sense and follow our inner knowing.
Well, actually, one of the new parts of the book is this revolution in tree science over the last, I would say, almost 40 years, where in 1990, Mark Harmon and Jerry Franklin co-wrote an article in Science showing that, quote, harvesting timber like a crop was carbon dioxide giving or killing, you might say, while allowing old growth to continue its growth, you know, untouched by human hands, is what creates a living earth.
But why do we need science for this? I mean, I understand that there are people, because science will cause like mainstream to listen, perhaps, though I posit that it's a psychological awakening and that I do believe trees might be considered a tool for that spiritual awakening, that connection with nature. Is it really science that's going to say stop cutting old growth? Or is
the reason why we need science is sort of like in medicine, for example, in the 19th century, doctors were killing women in childbirth. And when the science could show that it was because the doctors didn't wash their hands because there were germs, we could change the minds of a larger population and, you know, accelerate intelligence. Mm-hmm. And to show that trees, for example, this, and these are amazing facts which are in the book and new to the book, because these are ideas that are generating in the last 20, 30 years, is that, for example, trees create a water cycle that basically provides most parts of the world with 40 to 50% of their rain, when earlier in science, we thought that it was all evaporation of ocean water. So to understand that in a provable way allows us to value more greatly what trees do and cause the action of bodies to protect those trees. So the reason we need science, but it's also difficult sometimes because there are so many competing interests that wish to blind us to what science tells us. For example, we're only starting to realize, you know, I'm talking about us, you know, the population. Yeah. We knew about carbon dioxide since, and this is another work I could send you I've done, is in 1856, a woman named Eunice Foote discovered that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. And she said explicitly in a scientific paper that was published that not only is carbon dioxide a greenhouse gas, but more of it would heat up the earth.
And what year was that?
1856. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can send you my work on that if you're interested.
Yeah. So I think that, I'm not denying that science is important at any stretch. I am not denying that. I think that we're at the point, though, where, you know, there's certain things that some people just know, and you know, and it could be discarded because there's no scientific proof. Though I think that trees, for example, communicate. They do communicate. I've heard them communicate.
Well, I'm not going to talk about that because I don't believe that. Trees do amazing things, and I don't have to go into. I think, you know, myself, I go up every day into a forest I love it. That's all I can tell you about. I love it. We have these big oak forests, like about 6 blocks from my house, in wild area that goes on and on into the mountains. Which I explore every day. And as a child, too, I've always loved trees. But what I emphasize in a forest journey is what we can actually tell people trees really do. In a way, I would keep people out of the forest because they do so much harm. For example, a colleague from Canada told me all the big fires during the spring were caused by people in entering the forest. In fact, forest fires have increased over the last, say, 200 years. One of the reasons was in the 19th century, it was the trains with the cow catchers. And most of the damage in Canada was to faulty ATVs, for example. Mm. So anyway, what I try to show people, and I think that's the most effective way, is the truth, what trees do for us and how grateful we should be to the trees for doing this for us, making a livable planet.
Well, that is true. That is true. And then there's also truths that we might be open to as well. But I'm not saying, of course, that is all true. And I think, well, let me just go on to one point about the benefits. Let's just go into this benefits of trees, because we in forests, we talked about this as well, that pandemics.
Oh, yeah. Well, for example, you take Ebola. Actually, you can pinpoint where Ebola is going to strike with the when loggers go in and cut down the old growth. And what happens is a very interesting and complex experience. What happens is, and this is beginning with Gilgamesh 5,600 years ago, once you create a road into the forest, then you start cutting down the trees. Then you start to transport the trees to faraway areas. And with that transportation come all these diseases. And this is the biggest sin of the World Bank, has financed roads into the forest. And like I say, it all began almost 6,000 years ago with Gilgamesh. Is once Gilgamesh opened a road to the forest, that's when the first patterns of extreme deforestation began. In fact, one of the interesting things that I'm working on right now is, and you read the article that I posted on LinkedIn, is the relationship to trees and human technology. And what I'm going to write too in the future is that slavery and deforestation are inextricably linked, is the reason why people, enslaved people, was to cut down the trees and grow crops that brought immediate profits, like sugarcane. In fact, chapter 13 of the book covers that entire story about the direct relationship between two evils, deforestation and slavery. Mm-hmm. And then there's another example of, because we always thought in a very racist way that Africa was a dark continent where there was no progress. What my work shows is that the Africans were far ahead of the Western civilization mm-hmm. in producing steel, for example. And actually, the most valuable slaves were not, their value came from Africa, where they had learned to work in iron. And so when they were sold in America, the iron workers from Africa were far more valued. In fact, allowed the South to semi-industrialize, not because they learned it by their benevolent masters in America, but because they learned it in Africa. Because we have all these racist views that Africa was a dark continent where no progress had ever been made, we only view the progress could happen in America.
Well, we being one worldview story that has been proliferated upon mainstream, right?
Right. But to get back to trees and disease is that actually the first disease described from cutting down the forest is also in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was written like 5,600 years ago. And for example, in eastern United States, the main cause of Lyme disease is the fragmentation of the forest. And the reason for that is the forest, and this is how valuable they are, allowed for a positive relationship between predators keeping down the population of more generalized animals like mice. And once we deforested that area, the predators died. The mice proliferated because there was no longer a control. And they are the perfect incubator for the tick larvas.
The mice are. Wow.
Yeah. The white-footed mouse. And a white-legged mouse, sorry. And so what happened was you have a proliferation of a disease-carrying generalized species. And the same thing happened in Amazon, where once you lose the forest, you have this spread, malarial spread. As somebody actually in a little bit of, say, sarcastic humor said, deforestation bites back.
Yeah, no pun. When you were talking about like railroads and highways are the beginning, it's the beginning of the end, right? The Amazon has recently been on this trajectory of destruction, right? And that's what, 30, 40 years? How many years since the Trans-Amazonian Highway?
Oh, I'm not sure, but I think it was 30 or 40 years. Actually, I think, didn't I send you pictures of the waterfalls?
You did, yeah.
I could see when we went to the waterfalls on the Jari River, which is a tributary, you could see areas that looked like the Middle West already, you know, because the trees had been cut. In fact, this is what really, I guess you call it, really inspired me as I wrote the book, is I took lots of backpack trips into rainforests in southern Mexico. You have to understand, because I live in California, Mexico is very proximal. And I could watch how when people entered the forest, how the changes occurred, which I was writing about. In fact, in the mountains when I was climbing some high peaks, I saw these trains of burros, you know, donkeys, carrying charcoal to the city. Because in a more tropical area where you have mountains, the tree line is much higher than in a temperate area like the United States. And so from 14,000 feet, you could see these donkey trains, you know, carrying charcoal, carrying shakes. And this was exactly what I had been reading, say, in Homer's Iliad. And so I could see the reality of my book in the present, because the human intrusion into the woods continues to this day.
Well, when we say the intrusion into the woods, to go in and enjoy the forest and to backpack versus to go in and extract, right? That's a very different conversation. And
right.
I've seen, you know, I've lived in places where I've seen destruction, and I've witnessed before there was a thing called climate change, you know, before like we actually that term was coined when we were still like the environmentalists, you know, and you can feel the temperature was different after 10 years of extreme logging, including big second growth and old growth redwood trees. So living in a place like that, you can feel it. Where I live right now in New Jersey, it's like 10 degrees cooler than just a little bit south. It's the forests here. It's obvious. So Jonna, I have a question for you, and I'm always thinking about this, and this sort of goes to my nonlinear approach to forests and nature in general. I'm a total believer in many perspectives of science. I also just have a sense of things, and usually that sense 20 years later rings true and is scientifically confirmed. And there has been a lot written about this. I wonder what you think if electrification of Earth, right? Like we've significantly increased electrification on this planet between, you know, cell phone towers and all the EMFs and all the connectivity. How do you think, if you think, that this is affecting forests?
I have no idea. So I don't offer opinions where I have no knowledge.
Okay. Well, I'd be curious if that comes up in any of your research because it's...
No. What comes up in my research, actually, and I think this is one of the most incredible things that I learned, is the importance of roots. Now, roots have been estimated and underplayed. For one reason, it's very difficult to, you know, find where roots end, but at least 30% of the biomass of a tree are the roots. And what the roots do is they take rainwater, which is called carbonic acid, which is diluted carbon dioxide. And through the action of the roots, as they feed the tree, see, I think trees are amazing. I want to cover everything that trees do. What happens is the leaves are like solar panels. If you put an ammeter into a tree, you will get an electrical current. I don't know if you're aware of that. And so what happens is, we could only explain photosynthesis with Einstein's idea that light is not only a wave, but a particle with energy. So the particle with energy strikes the chloroplast, creates an electrical charge that allows for the process of photosynthesis to happen. Now, what the roots do is they provide the tree by going into rock of the various, you might say, supplements that trees need to survive. Like, oh, for example, magnesium, you know, calcium, for example, and usually collect more of those minerals than the tree needs. So what happens is they exhale, you might say, exude the extra minerals that mix with the rainwater that locks in carbon dioxide, which eventually goes to the ocean and gets locked away for hundreds of millions of years as limestone. I mean, these are the things that are amazing. You know, it gets locked into limestone, and also the calcium carbonate, which the trees form with those minerals and the rainwater. Also, you know, they eventually end up in the sea, and they provide seashells with their shells, because the shell is calcium carbonate too. So like I say, the whole system is a system of life. And when we destroy trees, we destroy life.
Yeah.
And that's scientifically what we know. And I agree with you, we feel. I think one of my, you know, very visceral experience is when I was in the Jackson State Forest. Have you heard of that? In Mendocino?
Yeah. Yep.
I was helping a friend who had a little vineyard, and I would go into the Jackson State Forest and, you know, take some of the mulch and bring it out to his vineyard.
Mm.
And so the richness of soil,
The
creation of soil by trees, I could go on and just talk about the science of the value of trees for life. And, you know, I could preach a sermon every day of the week.
Well, why do you think people are, you know, so disconnected from that? It should be built into our psyche, our psychic knowing. Why do you think people are disconnected?
Well, because basically they're in their cars all day, right?
Right.
You know, but even times past, even during Gilgamesh, when he cut down the cedar forest 5,600 years ago, which set the pattern of what we are seeing today, it was a fact of human hubris, you know, believing that we are the creators.
Yes. Yes.
Not realizing that we are just one small part of a living earth. And it's in our religions too, where we think we're created in the image of God, but none of the life forms in the world get the same stature.
Right. They were all created for us.
They are all created for us. But see, what's interesting, at least in the Old Testament, there's a lot of backpedaling in that. And for example, in Isaiah, when, you know, the Messiah does is plants trees in the desert, the acacia, the cedar, you know, the oak, and that brings water. And so the rich and the poor are equal because everyone has the same resources. So you get a mixed message in the Old Testament, and I've actually collected them. The worship of the cedar tree, for example, or in Isaiah, where he says very exuberantly, he makes himself into a cedar, into an oak tree, and he says, now that Sargon the Great, you know, who's the ruler of the world, has been killed, I, the oak, am now happy and will flourish again. I think it's a conflict in humans because I think humans realize sometimes what they're doing. One of the biggest problems, I think, is the whole idea of liberal economics, where we look at life as just one big account book. And so we totally disassociate ourselves from what we're considering worthless. And what do we consider worthless? The most valuable aspects of existence, A, the air, B, the water, and see the trees.
Yes, yes, amen. I'm writing a book right now, and it's called, the working title is What Ancient Trees Can Teach Us About Our Future Human Potential. And it might quote your book a little bit. I'll ask for permission. I'm really focusing on the psyche. And at what point, like, what is it? You're bringing forth a lot of very specific, tangible, like, look, you can't ignore this. And here's how we can improve. Here's how we can move forward. And there's that one piece of like, what is it going to take in the psyche of actually saying, okay, let's do it. You know, there's so many people writing on systems change and sharing like new models for finance and for, well, not even finance, but for economics, which maybe doesn't center around finance, but it balance in a circular economy of sorts. So I wonder if you can just speak to a little bit about the future potential. What is our future? But given where we are now, and it's so complex, John, right? Like, I had a neighbor over who's lived in this area where I am for like 70 years, and he knows these forests very well and gave me a lot of the history. And a lot of the history is actually in your book about this area. I was really impressed with that. And it was so educational to learn, though it's complicated. Like, this used to be a chestnut forest. And now then they brought the Chinese chestnut because it was more robust. They had like bigger chestnuts or something. And so now, all of the, there's like no more native chestnut. It doesn't grow anymore. It can't grow. It gets infected with whatever, or I don't understand the science of it, but it doesn't work here. It's a problem. Like, not only are we losing native habitat, which has the memory of the ecosystem, right? What are your thoughts for moving forward? Can we be planting non-native forests? What are your thoughts about native forests and how we move forward?
Well, my thoughts about native forests is they have to be like protected.
If they remain. I mean, we have beetles, we have disease, like things are dying off, right? How do we replant?
Well, for example, I don't have a car and I ride my bike everywhere and it's kept me extremely robust physically. And it also allows me to see so much more than someone driving even 20, 30 miles an hour. I can see birds, I can see bugs, I can, you know, go into the forest. We have to put a price on air because I was just reading a study that shows that even low levels of pollution contribute to Alzheimer's. And the cost of, you know, these diseases are astronomical. And so we have to put a cost. And like I say, for example, you know, Alzheimer's creates a huge money drain and also creates a huge human drain. Another example is the heat. For example, urban forests take down the temperature by almost 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So instead of building parking lots, we should be building parks in an urban area. For example, a lot of countries depend on water power for their electricity. So as we deforest, we just get torrents, for example, and then you have no electricity for maybe 9 months a year. One of the best examples, a concrete example, is, for example, the city of New York. What they did was they bought the rights for $1 billion to the watersheds of the Hudson, and it saved $9 billion from, you know, investing in a water filtration plants. And New York has some of the healthiest water in the world now because it comes from the tree-protected watersheds of the hills above New York City. Seattle is the same way. For example, they bought up the rights to this whole area that protected the watershed. And so we have to put a value on what earlier economics considered valueless, but what is invaluable, because without water, we don't do too well. Without air, we don't do too well. I was looking at today the difference between parking lots, which create terrible heat islands, not to mention all the emissions in building them into, once again, into tree lands. So the whole balance sheet has to change. And the problem is we have all these special interests. Like one best example is in Texas, where renewables has saved the state in these hot days.
Yeah.
And yet the legislature is trying to ban renewables or make it very hard for renewables to promote, you know, fossil fuels. The whole problem, it's called money.
Yeah. Also, we need to tap into the next level of renewables, because the renewable depends on extraction of minerals and rare minerals that are recreating just as much of a, well, maybe not just as much.
Because I know this because it's my other field. Compared to building any other power source, one of the greatest aspects, values of renewables is they don't require cold water to operate. And because of global warming, the water is becoming very warm.
Yeah.
And so all other forms of power not only won't work because you require what's called a thermodynamic cycle, where you have to have cold water to enter in a power plant, then it heats up, and then it empties out and takes in more cold water. And if you don't have a large temperature differential, it just doesn't work. But also, it's creating hotter water. Or you take the nuclear power plant up about 100 miles north of Santa Barbara, where the intake tanks kill millions of mammals, sea mammals. So it's all a comparison. I mean, you take also with solar cells, they're built, the primary material is silicon, which comes from sand. If, as long as people want electricity, which most people do, you consider the differences. And when you consider the differences, renewables are amazing. And in fact, if they're put on your rooftop and the need for a power plant. So this,
not if it's centralized electricity.
But also, once again, the trees come into play, because the more trees you have in an urban environment, the less electricity you need. And also it becomes equal, because the entire city can stay more habitable. Now, the question is, how much horror does the population require to come to an intelligent decision? See, we have to end the notion that hurricanes, for example, are a natural threat, or we have to come to an idea that weather and climate are very different, when we see weather as a one-day, two-day affair, but climate is an overall effect. So I think people are coming to a realization, I think, that there is climate change happening and it's making a pretty miserable planet.
I want to ask you a closing question. One opportunity that we have is, there's something called, are you familiar with the term psychic numbing? I forget, there's an author of the book who wrote a book called Around This, Psychic Numbing. I'll put it in the show notes if I remember.
Oh, psychic numbing.
Yeah, psychic numbing, a phenomenon where, for me, 250 whatever million years is such a big number that I have a hard time, my brain has a hard time putting it anywhere. So I can't process that. Or if you think of 10 million people just died from a famine, it's such an unfathomable, hard number to grasp that was just like cognitive dissonance, or, you know, it's like hard to grasp. So we take things like climate. It's such a big thing. It's hard to grasp, right? Climate in my house, climate on the planet, so big. Oh my gosh. But if you think of nature or your natural or forests, the forest by your house, the water in the stream, right? If you bring it down to earth, pun intended, and we start to use language that people can identify with, right? It's like we can identify with climate when we're in the middle of a heat wave and it's affecting me, or we just go inside and turn the air conditioning on. I don't have air conditioning. It's an experience in New Jersey not to have air conditioning because, you know, like for people who do, they don't even have to think about it. It's hot. Oh, I'll just go inside. We're becoming so desensitized to what's going on the planet. And I think that some of the words we're using are perpetuating the disconnect for people. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that sitting under a shade tree when it's 10 degrees cooler really has an effect on someone.
Yeah.
I think day after day, you know, temperatures above 110 degrees, you get fatigued.
Yeah.
But I think where we both can intersect in agreement, where when we consider that, oh, the Earth is a living system.
Yes.
And for example, I think what really opened my mind was in 2018, as I was working on the book in 2020, just as COVID really struck.
Yeah.
And I hit on an article in a scientific journal. Mm-hmm. It was called Bats, Deforestation, and Coronavirus.
Yes.
Really, really struck a chord in my mind. When science, when intersect with reality and knowing people who have had COVID, you know, you start to be careful, I guess, and you start to realize the importance of creating a safety distance, which forests provide.
Yeah, and people took to the forest, literally. People left New York City and took to the forest when pandemic hit.
Well, actually, that's interesting because there was a kind of a very delightful novel called The Decameron that was written in the 1400s when during the bubonic plague, the same thing happened. I don't know if you've heard of The Decameron.
No, people left the city, the people who could afford to, the wealthy people.
Right. It's called social distancing in the extreme. Yeah. What you did was called social distancing in the extreme.
Yeah, I didn't do it. People did it. I saw it happening all over the place. I was like, go away, go back to the city.
Right. But I think, and this is another value of the trees, and I write about it, is that trees act like a natural social distancer where it kept all these diseases at bay. Mm-hmm. But then when we invade, and I think this is a hard thing for people to put around their heads, but humanity is an invasive species.
Oh, yes, man. Aho.
You know, it's an invasive species. Yeah. We're actually parasites because we consume and don't provide any value or lasting value. I think you have symbiosis.
I think we could provide lasting value. I think if it didn't outweigh the benefits outweighed the harm, we might be able to see that we do. We add beauty and we can add a lot.
Well, actually, it's once again, it comes to social justice where people want to have so much more that they are willing to, you know, force a fiction on humanity as the oil industry did for like the last 40, 50 years about the consequences. One of the biggest problems is it's sort of like, the Midas myth.
Yeah.
You're familiar with that? Where Midas wanted gold. And so the gods turned everything into gold and he starved to death. But the best story actually comes from Ovid, where there was this king who loved to cut down trees. And suddenly he came upon this old growth. All the his timbermen wouldn't touch it because they said the tree is so big. This is 2,000 years ago. A tree so big must be protected by the gods.
See? Yeah.
And so, but then the king, what he did was he fired all his lumbermen and started cutting down the tree. And the goddess of abundance, Ceres, it was her tree. It was like a protected, you know, like John Muir, like a, you know, national forest, like a old growth that had the a goddess's protection. And so what she did was she created a insatiable appetite in the person who cut down this beautiful old growth. And so he ordered his servants to bring him all the food of the countryside, but that no longer satisfied him. To bring all the food from the continent, that no longer satisfied him. To bring all the food of the world, and that did not satisfy him. And so once he ate everything of the world, he started eating himself.
Aha! Well, that, what is the, can you give us the name of that again?
It's called, it's by Ovid, and it's called Astratian.
Beautiful.
And that's exactly what we're doing. We're starting to eat ourselves because, I mean, the heat waves.
Yeah.
You know, for example, the air quality. Yeah. So what we're doing is exactly like this tale told like 2,000 years ago.
Yes, it is.
And I actually can send it. I can send it to you if you'd like. I wrote a piece on this.
That would be great, John.
Would you like me to?
I would. And I'm looking at the time and I'm thinking we have to wrap up.
We do have to wrap up.
Yeah. We could talk trees and beautiful stories all day because these aren't really stories, right? These are, there's, I don't see this as myth. I think it's very, very true. It's, we don't really know. We only know what we know. We don't know what we don't know, right? And we don't even know what we don't know we don't know. So we could
But I think the real problem is that the voracious appetites of, say, corporations.
That's a whole other podcast, John.
Yeah, it's a whole other podcast. right. But yeah. It's like Hurwitz with, you know, with.
Yeah, I would have loved to share that story. But it's very true. I mean, it's the Hurwitz wasn't living there among the old growth, you know, feeling the energy being, you know.
But also he and what's his name, Millikan?
Yeah. Let me just tell you a little story about the closing story, because it really does bring home the Ovid that you just shared, is that the friend of mine who inspired my journey to law and everything, my friend David Gypsy Chain, who was killed by a logger throughout our activism days, right? When we were working to protect the ancient redwoods, that John Hurwitz, a Texas, you know, corporate, the owner of Maxham Corporation, they were liquidating this forest that they had acquired through a junk bond bailout. And so the Ovid part here is that my friend was killed by a logger in 1998, and we spent years working for, you know, to seek justice in this case, working with his mom. And it turns out, I don't know if it was about a decade later or maybe less, his son was killed like in a boating accident. And so I am not saying anything about anything, but I don't know. I didn't really follow his story much afterwards. But when I saw that, I thought, oh, how interesting, you know. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, obviously, but it was just an interesting, we don't know what we don't know, how things work.
But we know a lot when prophets, you know, shut our mouths to telling the truth.
Well, that I agree on. And that, my friend, is a whole other podcast.
It is.
That's a chapter. That's three chapters in my book. So
It is. I think we've had a good talk.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think?
I do. I'd love for you to just share one short thing that is the most marvelous aspect of trees in your mind.
Wow. I think I could talk all day about that. But basically, they provide everything that the living world needs. One thing that I learned from doing the new edition is how interconnected everything is.
Yes.
And once we cut off one of the connections, everything else like changes too.
Yes.
And trees basically created our world with Archaeopteryx changing the atmosphere from overloaded with carbon dioxide and underweighted with oxygen. So it's basically the creator of life. Yes. And trees are the creator of life. And that's why we have to value them, because our lives depend on the trees.
Yeah, very much feel that. And I want to just direct everybody to where you can find John's work in the show notes. And A Forest Journey is the book that we've been circulating around. It is a beautiful book. The role of trees in the fate of civilization. We barely touched the surface of what this book actually is. Yeah.
I would like to add that because Patagonia did it, it's the one book on forests that didn't use a single tree, didn't take a single tree to create.
I love that. 100% recycled.
Not only 100% post-consumer recycled.
I love that in the beginning of the book, there's an environmental benefit statement on the first page of the book. This is beautiful. It's a beautiful book with gorgeous photos, and it's a whole journey that you get to go on.
So actually in the New Yorker, they mentioned they talked about all these other books that took so many trees to make. And they said that A Forest Journey didn't go that route.
I mean, it's these oxymorons that are really what are the problem, right?
So. Exactly. That made me the happiest.
Amazing, John. Thank you so much for all the work that you do and for your time today. And I look forward to listening to this episode a lot and revisiting some of the stories that you shared. I appreciate you. Thank you. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Catalyst Talks. Stay tuned for what's up next, and please subscribe to our podcast and rate us wherever you listen. You'll find these all at catalysttalks.com. Join the conversation on social media. And if you'd like to reach out, please send me, Stephanie, a private message through stephanietraeger.com. Your attention means the world to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you.